Signwords Tape Ministry, Queensland. It's now Saturday evening, the 9th of May, 1987, and we're at the home of Dr. Peter Ravenscroft at Hawthorne. This is for a Christian Medical Fellowship evening, and the guest speaker, of course, is none other than Dr. Peter Ravenscroft. His subject this evening is Suffering Part 2, A Husband's Point of View.
Father, as we come to this lounge room in which we've so often sat, we come with a sense of awe at what you've done through this family. And yet, you are an awesome God, and we shouldn't in any way be amazed at what you can do and have done. And we would just pray for Peter and for Simon and for Kylie. Thank you for each one of them. We pray that in each and every facet of their ministry, at work, at home, at church, together, they would reflect the beauty of Jesus in such a way that sinners would be shown the way of salvation, come to know you as Lord and Savior. We thank you for the fellowship we have in Jesus Christ. We pray that you would use this time to our benefit. In his name. Amen.
I'd like to welcome you myself. Unfortunately, I haven't had a chance to say hello to everyone due to Chinese meals and other scurrying around the place out the back. I hope I will before the night's out. I want to talk to you, I guess, about my perspective through Heather's suffering. And I thought that, first of all, I should tell you just a brief history of what actually happened, so that for those of you who don't know, you'll understand. In December 1980, when Kylie was 10 and Simon was 8, Heather had a mastectomy, and then she had adjuvant chemotherapy. She was well until 1983, when she required radiotherapy and an oophorectomy. And she had further recurrences requiring further chemotherapy and surgery. And she developed erythema multiforme during the final lot of radiotherapy. And then subsequently, she developed a recurrence in the right brachial plexus and began to get severe pain. Subsequently, she developed paralysis in her right arm, and then later a left hemiparesis. And finally, she was unconscious for some 10 days before she died here at home. She was 39 when she died. Now, it won't be possible for me to discuss all the aspects of this experience. Heather has talked about her own understanding of her suffering in a tape that's been referred to in August 1985. And I thought that what I would do would talk to you about some of the ideas and experiences that I had, on the understanding that it would be fair for you to ask questions at the end about the things that I really haven't covered. Now, firstly, breaking the news. After Heather had her mastectomy, I came home, and the children and I and Gran, that's Heather's mother, who will be known as Gran from henceforth, sat down and we talked about what had happened. And the children's clear questions were, was Mummy going to die? And we discussed the pros and cons of it then. And then we went later to visit her in hospital after tea. And we maintained, I think, from at least my point of view, as complete a frankness with the children throughout Heather's illness as we could. Now, as the initial trauma of the actual incident and the surgery wore off, two major problems became mine to deal with. The first one was what I'll call self-pity. There were questions like, what will happen to me and the children if Heather dies? Now, I think these questions were the most potently destructive ones that I had to deal with. And I came, after struggling over and over again, to the situation where I realised that this was part of the folly of being anxious about tomorrow, which Jesus so clearly talked about. It was free-floating anxiety about the future, which needed dealing with very effectively if I was going to make it. I was fortunate, I guess, because we had had lots of interest in the family, in our family history. And it turned out that as we looked into it, we had a motto. And the motto was Deus Passit Cornutos, which means God feeds the ravens. And of course it's the answer to the question about not being anxious about tomorrow, because God himself cares for even the birds. And it became clear to me that if I was going to make it, that this was something that had to be faced. And it was wonderful to think that for hundreds of years my family had lived under that motto, and that it was my turn to do so. The second question was that of self-doubt. There were questions basically which revolved around, how will I cope without heaven? They kept surging through my mind, because in the unity of our marriage over the years, apart from our love, there was the melding of common wisdom and competence in many practical areas. And I was dependent on her for so much. From bouncing off her the problems of human relationships at work to the very basic meals and management of the household. And I knew that I'd have to do without those. And I came after thinking to realize that this question is, of course, a subset of what we have previously dealt with. It's part of the temptation about being anxious for tomorrow. And I needed to ask the Lord to help me to live just one day at a time in respect to this particular problem of attaining my own identity when I was separated from the unity of marriage. And these were thoughts that came on over a long time, because this illness evolved over a long time. It was not the acute, devastating illness of a sudden death. And because of that, the doubts and the questions were more persistent. Now, there were other questions that were equally important. One of them is, why is this happening to Heather and to us? Now, although this was an important question, Heather and I had discussed the problem of affliction a number of times, particularly in the time of our own personal renewal, when we had left Australia and gone with the two little children to the United States. Because there, as a fellow, we had had a period where we had absolutely no money and we had really no family. And it was there that we began to re-evaluate what it meant to be truly Christian without the home resources that and family resources that are so readily available within the community in which you lived. And then there was the time of coming to grips with the reality of the scriptural basis of life and the contact with the people of Labrie on the way home. And Heather has recounted much of that in her tape, and I won't go over it. But there was much thinking at that time, and the reality and the strength of Christianity to cope with even the most devastating situations had been thought about and discussed beforehand. And later, as we read Edith Schaefer's book called Affliction, we talked and discussed that long before Heather had had any malignant disease at all. And of course, for me and for others of us who live in the face of illness and death, these sorts of questions are very significant and often come to our mind as requiring resolution. Now, we had to come, and we did come to understand in a prior situation, that suffering and death are real consequences of the historic and personal sin that we have. And that this is not God's initiation, nor his intent, but as a result of the fall. Now, it's very clear also, though, that in answering this question, we need to examine ourselves, and we did. Because it's certainly true that amidst the adverse experiences of life come great learning, and God can teach us much from that. We value the importance of knowing and understanding something of the Christian perspective of the nature and the reasons for suffering before they happen. And it seemed to me that this is something that we all should learn, since we're all going to suffer. And that is that we should begin with our children in reality, and ourselves face the basis and the understanding of this before we are caught up into the emotional grief and devastation of the actual happening being right here amongst us. And if we do not, then I think we leave our children and ourselves open to great difficulty at the time. I think it was also important to discuss amongst ourselves the biology and the pathology of the cancer itself, so that this disease to the children and to ourselves, because Heather was not medically trained, should be understood at the level of the rational and questioning person. And so we discussed the nature of the disease and dispelled from it something of the mystery that it might otherwise have. And thirdly, I think that in dealing with this subject, it's important that we speak with care about the issues to our children. And I have a young nephew whose mother died when he was very small. And his grandparents told him this, that the Lord has taken his mother to be with him. And that boy's response was this, that he hated the Lord for taking his mother, and he would not pray to the Lord for doing it. And children understand the dynamics of relationships, and so that as we deal with children, we need to be very clear in our thinking, though not necessarily tremendously detailed in our teaching until they grow in their understanding. Now, a further question that we had to face was, why was Heather not healed? Now, we certainly prayed and continued to pray for healing and for the success of the medical treatment and for the doctors who were looking after Heather. And as it seemed more evident that the disease was not being controlled, it was as if more and more people came offering their solutions to this problem. Some came with, quotes, proven remedies, close quotes, with the names of healers in other places, with suggestions of healing services held by many different groups, and with tracts and with books. Now, Heather actually considered each one of these books and each one of these suggestions most carefully. We discussed most of them in the time that we had together in the mornings. And we are often frustrated and angry because the ideas presented were so far from the biblical truth. And Heather would then, when she could, explain to those who gave her the material how she saw the issues. And in that way, she often helped them to wrestle with the issue themselves. And it was very humanly true that many of them were trying themselves to resolve the very issues that we were facing in real life. Now, we seem to be faced with two main fallacies. To me, there was the existential perspective. What they were saying to us was, hope like mad against overwhelming odds, and healing will happen. And if you have enough faith, it'll be okay. And then there were those with what I'd call the technical approach. If you could only just get the right technique in your prayers and your life, then you could successfully manipulate God. If you had the right key, then God was like a vending machine and the answers would come. Now, perhaps they're simple and rather crude illustrations. But to me, this is something of what the ideas really boil down to. And I honestly wondered, and so did Heather and I, if some of those who gave us the material that we read had really read it themselves and really understood what it was saying. Some of the material was wonderful and tremendously helpful, but I hope that you will understand the balance of what came to us at that time. Now, personally, I do not have the complete answer to why Heather was not healed, but I do have a sufficient one. I think, firstly, we should say that this very question of why there was no healing is a proper one to ask, and to ask very seriously and persistently. Because affliction and death are enemies, not to be accepted passively, as many in modern society do. Job would not give in and passively accept his suffering without questioning and refuting the false explanations that came from his so-called friends. Unanswered questions are often destructive, and true answers are power that can be used to conquer despondency that so often comes with affliction. And it's important to note that Job was not criticized for the questions he asked of God. What he was criticized for was drawing hasty conclusions without adequate knowledge of the reality of life in both its seen and unseen dimensions. Now, you'll remember that when Jesus came to the grave of Lazarus and wept, he was also angry at the impact of death on his friends, as recorded in John chapter 11. At his own impending death, Jesus was distressed and asked God if there was any other way out, as in Luke chapter 22. Now, we had times of weeping and anger, and we asked if there were any ways out. But we also knew this, that the Scriptures teach us that not only the great in faith and the evidently successful find honour and have long and happy lives. In Ecclesiastes, this very point is made, and perhaps I should just read that. In Ecclesiastes chapter 9 and verse 11, as the writer says, I saw under the sun that the race is not to the swift, and the battle is not to the warriors, neither is bread to the wise, nor wealth to the discerning, nor favour to men of ability, for time and chance overtake them all. And it won't take a moment to realise that in the world without God, about which we believe Solomon was writing here, that he was right to see the horror of injustice. But he was wrong in his conclusion that only time and chance governed all. And you can see that he was a very modern man, because if you asked the modern man without God today what governed all, he would say time and chance. And the answer was written in Ecclesiastes. It's important also to see the situation very clearly when we compare the great and the successful in the first part of Hebrews chapter 11. You'll remember the chapter where we see the great and read of the great names of the people of Israel. Remember, it goes by faith, Abel and Enoch and Noah and Abraham, and by faith, Sarah, and so on, as it acknowledges one after the other the great heroes of the Israeli nation. But we also need to realize that the end of this chapter talks about something else, other people, not the great and the honored and the long-lived, but it says this: and others were tortured, not accepting their release in order that they might obtain a better resurrection. And others experienced mockings and scourgings, yes, also chains and imprisoned. And they were stoned, and they were sawn in two, and they were tempted, and they were put to death with the sword. And they went about in sheepskins, in goatskins, being destitute and afflicted, ill-treated, men of whom the world was not worthy. And so you can see that there is this dichotomy between those of great faith who both live out long and successful lives and those who die nameless and in horrible circumstances. This we must understand in its clarity. Because we need also to understand that the books will be balanced at the end of all time. And this horror does not stand as it does for those who see a world which has no unseen part. Because if we turn to Revelation chapter 20, we see that even those who died in the situation that we have just read, unnamed and unremembered in the most horrible way, will have their names read from the book of life. So that what seemed to be a very horrible death is one in which God notices and values enormously. In Revelation chapter 20 and verse 12, and I saw the dead, the great and the small, standing before the throne, and the books were opened, and another book was opened, which is the book of life. And the dead were judged from the things which were written in the books according to their deeds. And the sea gave up the dead that which were in it. And the dead and Hades gave up the dead which were in them. And they were judged, every one of them, according to their deeds. And verse 15, and if anyone's name was not found written in the book of life, he was thrown into the lake of fire. And of course, the imputation is that the names of those of faith were actually there in the book, whether they were noticed by humans at the time or not. Now, in the face of such a basis, I myself had to come to a response. And I came to a point after much struggling to realize that there was the time when I must leave the matter in God's hands. I realize this because of my own finiteness. And you'll remember that this was a point that was made to Job. God said to Job, where were you when the worlds were created? That his judgment and his understanding, and of course ours too, are so limited that the whole dimensions of what exists cannot be wrapped up in our own minds. On the other hand, from my reading of the scriptures and my experience of God and his dealings with me, and also our family over the time, that I knew that he was absolutely righteous and loving and trustworthy. And this is something that as Christians, I believe we must build from the very beginning of our children's lives and incorporate into our own lives, the sensitivity to know how good and wonderful God has been over the long spectrum of the years. And not see life at the point of great difficulty as if it existed out of context, but to be able to look back. And therefore, we should build and treasure those times that we have together as families and to acknowledge God's place in it so that we have a tremendous memory of what he has done. So that in this way that when calamity comes, we see the situation in its true and open context. And so I believe from all that God had done for me, that though I couldn't know comprehensively because of my finiteness, that I could know sufficiently and that I could go on from there. I could also see from what was said in scriptures that not even Shadrach and Meshach and Abednego, as they stood before the fiery furnace, knew whether they would survive or not. Did you realize that? They did not know. Perhaps I should just read it to you so that you'll understand once more. In Daniel chapter 3, and verse 16, Shadrach, Meshach, and Abednego answered and said to the king, O Nebuchadnezzar, we do not need to give you an answer concerning this. If it be so, our God whom we serve is able to deliver us from the furnace of blazing fire, and he will deliver us out of your hand, O king. But even if he does not, let it be known to you, O king, we are not going to serve other gods or worship the golden image that you have set up. So that they in truth did not know, although they believed on the basis of what they had read and what they had experienced of God's nature before them. We should remember again the patriarchs of Israel as they are listed in Hebrews chapter 11, that it's said very clearly that they died in faith without receiving the promises. And so for us too, we may die without fully receiving the promises. And so I found that each day in my prayer time I needed and was able to acknowledge God's power to heal Heather in a very affirmative way. And yet I needed to leave the matter in his hands on the basis of all that I knew of him. Now that did not leave me with a peaceful feeling inside, but it did free me to fight the battle. I had times of sheer tiredness and weeping, mainly in the shower. And I was fascinated to read C.S. Lewis, when his wife died, used to cry in the shower too. Not too many ways I'm equal to C.S. Lewis, but we both cried in the same place. But the Lord kept me from self-pity and despondency. It was not really an easy time, as you might imagine. I was expected to cope, as usual, in spite of broken sleep, and little of my own time left for planning research and other things. Above all, at work there was a communication problem. Virtually all of my colleagues acted as if nothing was wrong and seemed embarrassed to ask about Heather. But I was deeply impressed with the research fellow who worked with me, who kept probing me as to how I was managing and asking me what was going on. And I think, although not a Christian, he had the most clear understanding of what the issues were, and it was helpful for me to talk with him. The battle in these circumstances of suffering really is, and still is for all of us, to create an atmosphere of love and care and beauty in our own environments and amongst our friends, in spite of these terrible difficulties, because our lives are to be an illustration of the Lord's own character. And he is implacably against suffering and death. Now there's much to give thanks for the support of friends, and there are many of you who have supported us through that time. I know that being alone through such an ordeal may well have been soul-destroying, and I feel for those who must suffer in this way in our own community. There were times of difficulty when some friends found it too difficult, and others whom we hardly know became just marvellously supportive. And at that time, I must tell you that I felt extraordinarily appreciative of Christians and of the church, so easily maligned by us by familiarity of just rubbing shoulders with those people from Sunday to Sunday. But when the situation is so difficult, the nature and the depth of Christian understanding produce such a wonderful support compared to those who did not have such a basis, that it was further evidence, I think, of the reality of what Christianity does do in the lives of and the thinking of Christians as compared to those who do not have the same basis. Now I want to tell you something of managing Heather at home. This was overall a wonderful experience, and what work was involved more than repaid by the rewards. Heather loved this old home, and she of course wanted to be here and not in hospital. But it was important to understand that it was her loving and trusting attitude that really made it possible. And it isn't possible for all patients to be managed at home. We had experienced the difficulties of having her in hospital, particularly when she had erythema multiforme. And it was a terrible drag on us as a family. The business of coming home from work, of having tea, of rushing to the hospital, was not only exhausting, but it wrecked homework and other routines that were necessary. And we were left wondering how she was through the night. At home, she was with us all the time. The children had come home from school, and they'd sit and talk to her about the day. And Gran and one of her friends, Beverly Pemberthy, saw to it that Heather had been washed and was ready and felt up to talking to her as far as was talking to the children as far as was possible. One of the real difficulties we faced was the chronic problem of her being bedbound as the time went on. It meant that she missed the conversation at meals and the shared time that we so enjoyed. But we found that, for instance, there are many ways round such a problem. The folding table brought into the bedroom, having breakfast or a meal together, so that she didn't miss out on this sort of problem. We were able to have devotions and sing a hymn together in the evenings, which we couldn't do, obviously, very easily in hospital. And I should tell you that it was at this time that I found that singing was so important. That during the times of before she was bedbound, when she had to shower and it caused her so much pain, we used to run through our repertoire of Sunday school choruses and all sorts of hymns and songs that we had learnt. And it was of tremendous support to us. I was reminded of Paul and Silas in prison singing, and also of the Russian dissident who was not long released, a Jewish dissident who was released from Russia, who said that what kept him going in solitary confinement was the singing of his boyhood Jewish songs. And I think for us, it's certainly for me, it was a lesson of how we ought to teach our children to sing and to maintain our knowledge of hymns and songs. And the Lord, of course, has asked us to do that, to greet each other with songs and psalms. Now, there were times of really considerable difficulty associated with a constant severe pain. There was trouble with adjusting her opiate medication because of the fine balance between an adequate dose and the nausea and vomiting that excess dosage caused. And the insertion of an epidural catheter 6 months before she died gave us a great deal of help and enabled her, for instance, to sleep through the night without having to wake to take increasingly frequent oral opiates. There are other ways too. For instance, earlier on when we were managing radiotherapy, we found that in fact her going to radiotherapy during the day was a terrible nightmare. She would sit in pain through many hours at QRI and then had difficulty and time wasting before she could get home, so that almost the whole day was taken. Whereas, in fact, we found that we could get a night appointment for 9 o'clock or so, and I could drive her across there and that she could have treatment without a lot of waiting, but if she did, she and I could talk together. Such manipulations and searching for ways to reduce the real trauma of these sorts of treatment can make an enormous difference to the welfare of patients. Now, as she became weaker and was unable to move herself in bed due to a left hemiparesis in the paresis of her right arm, we had to get up and turn her during the nights. And this was not only a problem for us, as you can imagine, I was seeing double most of the time, but also it caused her pain when we moved her. And the solution came in the form of a ripple mattress, which was loaned through the Blue Nurses by the Cancer Fund. And this completely solved our problem. And again, such things just make a total difference to managing disabled people at home. We were able to manage her right through until her death without any bed sores or pressure areas using this. Now, apart from Gran and Beverly Penworthy, as I've mentioned, the Blue Nurses did a great job, and I was tremendously impressed, being on the receiving end of Blue Nurses, how sensitive they were to coming into someone's home. Not barging in, as ward sisters do, and so on, but they soon became friends, and their respected attitude to us as people in our own home was deeply appreciated, and very important. And I have told the Blue Nursing Service how important that was to us. The only fun we had was on New Year's Day. The poor nurse who came had had a rather long night of it. She was so wobbly that I had to redo the dressing again. Now, I think it's important for us as doctors to realise that there is a tremendous advantage in being able for families to nurse their sick and perhaps dying members at home. But I think it's also important to realise that the resources required are very special. It's very hard to manage without someone at home who knows just what is going on and can at least call you with a good assessment. And Gran, having been a nurse, even though in the pre-antibiotic era, was certainly great at that. It's very hard also without a doctor to adjust the medication and do other things. And I know some general practitioners are willing to do it, but I found that it was very frequent and necessary. And so I think it's very important that we not press families who don't have the resources to undertake such care. But where it is possible, it's an amazing an important thing to be able to do. Now, at the time of Heather's death and after, there are just a number of things that I wanted to share with you. Now, Heather died here on April the 21st at 1 a.m. at home. And the children and Gran and I, we ended the odyssey that had begun 5 years previously by praying and weeping together. That was our personal time of parting here. And I think it's an experience that we should never forfeit. I wanted to comment to you on the wonderful flowers which so many sent to us. I thought that the choice of flowers was beautiful and unique and important because, as Heather was, they were created by the Lord himself. Now, I know that money spent on flowers could have been sent to the Queensland Cancer Fund or to the National Heart Foundation or some other worthy purpose, and that these groups should be supported consistently. But having the flowers in the way that I did reminded me of the anointing of Jesus' head by Mary at Bethany. Judas complained because he thought that the oil should be sold and given to the poor. But Jesus saw the unique significance of the occasion and was deeply appreciative. And I felt the same about the flowers that were sent. We went to the funeral with pockets full of tissues. But it seemed to me that the service itself was one of thanksgiving for us and personal reassurance that for Heather, as Paul said in 1 Corinthians 15, that her mortal had put on immortality. And that's what we were celebrating. I was deeply touched at the funeral that the staff and one of the parents of State High brought the children's closest friends, both boys and girls. Because at the funeral there were hundreds of people, but there were very few that the children knew. And to have those was just a marvellous experience for them. And I think the school showed a degree of understanding of the nature of life, which is very commendable and very important. Now, one morning in Petersfield in England in 1983, when we were reading, as we always did together, or when we almost always, before we got up for breakfast, Heather was reading a book by Dylan Thomas. And she said to me, "Listen to this." And she read this. "Time held me green and dying, though I sang in my chains like the sea." And after her death, I found those words written on a scrap of paper in her purse. I think they really epitomized her understanding during that whole illness that she had. There's a sense in which both she and us are held in the chains of our own body and the deterioration that we must suffer. But we are to sing in our chains. She sang in terms of her own life and witness. And unfortunately, Dylan Thomas, as far as we know, did not really understand an adequate basis for being able to sing in his chains. But we ourselves do, that we know the Lord, who is righteous and loving, and before whom our lives and decisions really matter. And so, when the books are balanced, what we have done during these times of life when suffering has been our lot will be in evidence, and we'll then be able to praise him as we ought. And so these are some, I guess, of just a selection of ideas and thinking that I have learned. And I thought it would be important that if you wanted to, you should ask me more detailed questions and perhaps some that you have thought you would like to know the answers at. And I would certainly be happy to reply.
Problems is always facing the time of moving from the fighting stage to the acceptance stage, and I wonder when that occurred for both of you before Heather's death.
I don't think that we ever left the fighting stage. It depends on what you mean by fighting. If you mean that we were fighting with the belief that Heather would be healed, and we turned from a time of passively, if you like, accepting that, then what I'm saying is this, that I think that as Christians, living with a finite and limited understanding that we have, that we have to understand that right until the end, we are to acknowledge that God has the power to heal totally. Now, if that, in fact, suggests that at the point of death that I should be disappointed that such power wasn't fully manifested, then what I was saying to you was that as we look across the history of God's dealing with men, that healing was not our right and prerogative, that both those that had enormous faith and lived good and happy and long and well lives. And those who had wonderful faith, if not more, died horribly. And though that we might long for healing, we have to realize that the consequences of the fallenness resulting in death is a reality in our own lives, and that we will have to deal with it in due course, each one. Now, what I was saying was that I don't know the total and comprehensive answer, in the way that Job did not know the comprehensive answer as to the basis of the illnesses which he had and the loss of his family and flocks. But what I'm saying is that God said that there was a rational answer and that it would be understandable to us when we are with him. But at the moment, in our own finiteness, that we have to live without the complete answer in that rational sense. But we, in turn, have answers. We have the answers of historic Christianity, of the nature of God, of his own dealings with us in our life before the onset of such a calamity. And such history we should accumulate and remember, because our death and sickness is not something that comes out of no background. And that also, that the long-term solution is there, that the books will be balanced in the resurrection when the Lord comes again. But what I wanted to say to you was that for those who feel that death has lost its sting, in a sense, by the fact that we are Christians, and therefore it doesn't seem to have any impact, if we have enough faith, to me those people are wrong. Because if you read 1 Corinthians 15, death has lost its sting when the body, when the person, has donned immortality. And in fact, that is at the point of death for that person. But at the end of that chapter, Paul gets on and says, let's toil and work against the sinfulness, that there are things to do, and that we are not to be passive, but that we are continue to create a life and an environment that God would want us to have according to his will. Now, that's a long answer, but I'm not sure if I've answered quite the question you meant. But the point is, I think, that we are not to stop fighting. And that though the loss of someone so wonderful is a blow, our problem is we don't see it in the total context now. But we do have a context. And in the same way that the forefathers of Israel died before the promises were finally made real to them, so we have deaths before the final promise of the resurrection will be true for all mankind. Now, this living within our finiteness is not something that's confined to religious experience. It's something that biologically and in the physics and the astronomy and other disciplines, we understand having to live without complete knowledge. So that it's not a leap of faith in the sense of just grasping onto something at the point of sickness and death, which may not even be there. But it's living in the reality of our own finiteness, in the history that we have, and the truth that we can also read and test for ourselves. Does anyone want to explore that further? That's a very testing question. Yeah.
I guess as medical practitioners, one of the big problems we do face is moving away from therapeutics which may have side effects, which are looking at cures or benefits to longevity versus therapeutics which are designed for palliation. That's really, I accept what you're saying before, okay, but in terms of the practicalities...
You're asking me a medical question.
Well, it involves the whole, I think, because that when you're in fact doing that, you are really shifting the emphasis away from looking at cure to more dealing with the problems of the whole person. And that to me is a very practical problem. I just had a call before I came tonight from a family in that situation. Mm.
The commitment to palliation in its total aspects for a Christian must be a prime focus, because death and its consequences, illness, are not to be seen passively as just our lot, but our enemy, because this is against the order of creation and God's love and purpose for us, so that we are to work intensely to find ways of making life, the life of those who may not be able to have the disease cured, better. And that means exploring the total possibilities, from looking at how we might help the family through to adjusting medications, getting in-home help and doing the whole spectrum of things, enthusiastically and purposefully, because this is the very centre of what we understand we should be. And not standing back and saying, well, this is sort of hopeless and, you know, as a doctor I can't contribute much. And what means you choose will have to be very carefully weighed. For instance, in the last course of chemotherapy, we decided, Heather and I decided, that in assessing what appeared to be the response and weighing that against the nausea and sickness of chemotherapy, that we would say to the oncologist that we were happy if he stopped. And we did. And we were happy that we stopped. And this comes into having realistic expectations. And perhaps it's a little harder for people who don't have the medical background and can sit and talk and weigh the odds and ends. And so that means that the doctor has to be very sensitive, I think, to the suffering. And I am personally very concerned about the impact of the side effects of chemotherapy when measured against the endpoints that are usually quoted, which is prolongation of life for a little bit. Very few studies really measure the quality of life, the nausea, vomiting, the days when people can't be part of their families and contribute and enjoy things. So we have to be very careful in our own understanding of what the treatment is doing and contributing to the whole aspect, so that we're not either too enthusiastic or passively dropping the whole thing when we shouldn't be. And that's hard clinical judgment.
I think possibly you've answered some of this question already, but perhaps you'd care to outline what differences this experience you've been through have made to you as a doctor.
It's always very hard to see yourself as other people see you. It's made me much more sensitive. For instance, not long after Heather died, an elderly lady came in to my ward, and she developed the most severe ascites and developed acute hepatic failure. And shortly after, a nun appeared on the scene, and it was her daughter, her only daughter. In fact, the two of them were the only surviving members of their family. And it made me really try to think what it meant for that person, the nun. And as we talked together, it became clear that not only was this her mother dying, but her whole connection with the world outside the church was about to disappear. The family home which she could go to in her vacation, and so on. I think it's this kind of sensitivity, the broader sensitivity that one might normally want to think about, that I guess that I've become a little bit more aware of. I'm not sure in what other ways. I'm much more sensitive about the toxicity of drugs and things, of course, but I stop them all anyway when people come in. That's what a clinical pharmacologist is for. I think it's very hard to say. One of the things that I had done before, which I realised was very important, was to meet with the nursing staff on the ward regularly and talk to them about the patients as individuals, as to try to see that not only was I worried about their medical problems, but their whole problems. And so they have become much more sensitive because of that. And I think there's the whole injection of what it is like to suffer. And obviously I'm sensitive much more to what death means. And I have trouble, though, because the way that I feel and have experienced it will be very different from other people. And I have to be careful as a doctor not to sort of project those things onto other people, but to really be aware of just where they are in the situation of things. I've got a lot more involved in the chaplaincy service in the hospital, trying to think out how they could work much more effectively. And that's a really interesting situation that other people here have been involved in as well. But I really have a hard time defining exactly what effect it's had on me as a doctor. I know what it's done to me as a father. It's made me a mother too. Not in the emotional sense, but at least in waving dishes and all sorts of things. It's made me sensitive to what it's like for a father who loses his wife. I was just saying earlier that it is very difficult. There is nothing given to someone at work in my sort of job as to whether he has a wife or not and children to worry about. You're expected to do the whole thing. Whereas I think for a wife who was left without a husband, she may have, I mean, they both have the loss of the relationships and that personal hardship, but the wife usually maintains time if she is able to manage on the pension so that she does her normal thing. She isn't expected to do a lot of other things sometimes. And so I think the stresses on husbands are very different to those that are on wives. And I think that's something that we should be sensitive to if we have patients, either husbands or wives, who are by themselves trying to manage. And certainly for me, after almost 20 years of leaving many areas to Heather, where she had great skills, I suddenly found that I had to try and manage, but my skills were so rotten. And yet I sort of had a high standard of myself. I wanted to do things like Heather did them, but yet no reasonable hope of doing it. And that's very frustrating. Very frustrating.
Peter, about disease and illness, you mentioned that we should fight it as because it's not part of the God's creation. Could you explain more about their acceptance as of diseases? As what Paul described as a thorn in his flesh, and accept it as part of our life.
Yes. Thank you. We have a problem in dealing with Paul's thorn in the flesh because, as far as I know, no one actually knew what that thorn was. So it could have ranged from anything from the physical through the psychological or whatever. I don't know. I think that there is a sense in which we have to live with ourselves when we have diseases. But there's a sense in which we ought to groan as the whole creation is groaning against our own fallenness and not accept it as being a disabling experience in in the whole of our lives and just passively sort of collapse and say, well, okay, I'm the victimized here and I need pity. What I think it means to us is that with the Lord's help, we should continue to be creative in whatever stream of activity we can, in our personal relationships, in our life. Now, it'll be very different for different people. But we can realistically accept those illnesses that we have because we understand something of the fallenness and also God's love for us. And that life doesn't end with the physical full stop of death. You see, if you begin with the humanistic approach that life is just all you have between birth and death, you run into this problem of how horrible it is for young and beautiful girls to be raped and killed. What an awful stop to life. How unjust. And those that are born maimed and handicapped in many ways. But there is a sense that as you, as a Christian, take the broader look and see the totality of life in both the seen and the unseen, that you see that the balance will occur and that justice will be done in the long term. And that your body will be renewed. I'm glad about that. It's not just our spirits that will be renewed, but our bodies will be renewed in the way that the Lord's was. So that we will have and maintain something of our identity that we have carried through life, and that what we have done during our lives will be meaningful in the whole history of humanity. Because God himself is a God of history, of longitudinal history. You see, that's where the writer of Ecclesiastes was wrong. He thought in the Buddhist sense that life just went round in circles and that there was nothing new under the sun. There is something new in God's world. There is the new right for individuals to decide and to live their lives with that freedom that God gives us and to create that which is beautiful, but also to have the opportunity to create with that which is horrible and also to live with the consequences of both. So that there is meaning to me, even for those whose bodies and minds are destroyed and maimed. And that's why I think we have to begin with our own children when they're young and explain to them the total perspective so that it's part of their understanding, so that when they meet these sorts of problems in others in their own lives, they will have some basic understanding from beforehand. And that's why the Jews in the Old Testament were told at the end of the Ten Commandments to talk about them when they got up and when they walked along the road and when they came in and when they went out. Because it's the rationality of life. It's the real truth of life we're talking about in Christianity, not a heap of little things you clasp onto when, like a crutch when everything else has fallen to bits. It's the real answers when you probe deep enough. So it's real power to cope with those problems. Now, that's not saying that all Christians cope well, because we are really fallen. We have the times of despair and so on. But we're here for each other's mutual comfort and building up, as well as standing in our own faith.
Christian, how does that affect how you explain death or minister death to a non-Christian? When they say, well, how can your God be loving if he's letting this happen to me, and when he doesn't see anything beyond that?
No, I think he doesn't, or she doesn't, in the way that you've put it. And the first thing we should do is agree with them that if they start with that perspective about God, there is no meaning. But that we must start at the very beginning and talk to them about the creation and the fall and the history of God's dealing with men and the questions that God answers in life, and to take them right through. Now, it's not often we have that total opportunity, but there are no pat answers for the truncated question like that. There are no answers that are adequate if you want to answer a question in science or medicine by giving some little off-pat comment either. You have to begin at the beginning often and explain the physiology and the pathophysiology and therapy and so on to make the whole disease be understood. And so we have to understand that the explanation of the Christian position requires time and complexity and not pat answers or single verses quoted as we pass by. And it's time consuming and it's difficult. But the answers are there, I believe, and they're fabulous and powerful. And the more you ask and the more you probe, the better the answers seem to be. The harder questions you ask, the better the answers seem to be. And that's why we shouldn't stop asking hard questions. That's not a proper answer to your question in total, because if you have someone in mind, then we have to understand that person and where they're coming from and what their notion of God is, and then begin to talk to them about whether their notion's right or wrong and work through. And often people come to you and they do want a pat answer like that, and sometimes we have to say, well, there isn't one, but if you want to talk about it, then my time's yours. And if they don't, they've taken a decision, unfortunately, that's very unfortunate.
Right. Yeah. Peter, it's very difficult for nurses who are dealing with seriously ill patients, and they often cope with it by cutting themselves off, and one often sees these patients in the end of the veranda out of sight. And I'm very interested in your comment that this has made you more sensitive of the nurse's needs, and I'm wondering if you could tell us a bit more about just what has been your experience there.
The important thing I think that we should understand about nurses, as I've learned, is that their perspective on disease and its management is not what your perspective may be. It's often totally different. And the issues they see as important or going wrong may not at all be the issues that we're struggling with at the time. And that's why I think it's really important that where we can, we talk to the group of RNs. And I have my meeting at a time when the day shift's going off and the night shift's coming on, and so they're all there. And most of them come, interestingly enough. And we talk about them, and we have to be honest in the sense that where things are not in our control and the pain's not relieved and difficulties are occurring, that we explain to them what the issues are and why things are not going right. And also to help direct them into the area where they can make a big contribution. Perhaps spending a little more time talking to the person on the night shift because they're anxious and so on. And that may be directing them in a non-medical. But once they get the feedback that those things that they're doing really, it's just catches like fire. And also that you're not a cold and inconsistent walks in for two rounds a week, out again, and leaves them with the management of the patient. That you really care about what's going on and you're available if need be. Now, the situation for consultants is different. But nurses are important, and such critical and sensitive people. And some of them get just terribly upset. You know, I had one charge nurse that was absolutely upset herself because one patient had died during the night. Mumbled, squirt of furosemide and left. And she knew that there was more to do. And you know, and she was left. And she just chewed on this for a couple of days, and then she sort of came at the end of the ward meeting and said, look, you know, I can't live with this anymore. And out it all came. And she wanted me to talk to the resident because she was worried that he would do the same thing to other people. And often the nurse's attachment for the patient to the patients is much greater than ours if we come just for odd ward rounds. And so their deterioration and their death is very much more noted and more concerned. And so I think it is important, and different people will be able to deal with it in different ways. What I'm saying is that whatever model that may work for me may not be at all appropriate for different people in different situations. And of course I think the doctor-nurse relationship is changing. It's becoming one of much more equal professionals than it used to be when I was a lad, where the carnation-bearing consultant wandered into the ward and issued orders and all scurried to do the bidding. But I must say to you that it's very hard and very distressing sometimes that in public wards it isn't always possible to have quite the sensitivity of management for individual patients that one would like. But it's not an area we should abandon, but it's one that we should take up and try to make work better in what ways we can. And I know that many of you are making very singular, important contributions in your own areas, and I wouldn't for a minute want to minimise any of that.
Question, so you can answer it how you like. Could you give us some thoughts on how doctors can talk to patients that are dying and their families? Some ideas on how to do it in a more sensitive way?
I'm glad I can give you any answer I like. I think it's a matter for the individual person to begin to develop for themselves. I think the important thing that I have found is that things always work better if that when I first diagnose the disease that's likely to be terminal, that I talk to the husband and wife or the family together at the very first point. And if I can get them into the ward and so on, all the better. But some way to tell them all together. And then I think the initial rapport is there, and that each in the family knows what the other knows. And they're not playing cat and mouse with each other, hoping not to hurt each other's feelings. That, I think, is the start. And once that, then it's a matter of sensitive understanding from there on in. And I'm not sure that I can give you any guidelines, but I can tell you that that we had a very interesting lady who had Jakob Kreutzfeldt. I think John remembers her very well, and she died over a period of many, many weeks, and her husband was just so grieving and lacked such tremendous understanding of what was going on. It just hit him like that. She was normal, as it were, at one point, and within 3 weeks she was completely demented, and shortly after she was bedfast and non-responsive. Then I think in that situation, we used to get him up and talk to him on the ward round and see how he's going and ask the social worker to talk with him and follow him. And he really appreciated that. There was just nothing we could do for this lady, except John sorted out the myoclonic jerking very nicely, and we were able to suppress that. And I think I have found that just knowing what's going on, knowing the person and what their situation is in some detail, is the best way to start, and then talk to them when you can. And I like to ask the nurse to get the patient's relatives up on the ward round every now and again so I can find out what's going on and talk to them, rather than having them free-floating around the place, not really relating to anyone. And that seems to have worked well. there are some situations where this sort of management is just a disaster from the beginning to end. And sometimes I don't really understand why it all goes wrong. And there are others in which you seem to click and you have a common understanding with the family and the patient, and you can cope with these things very well. But it's the humanness of medicine that we're talking about. It can't be legislated for, and it can't easily be taught in a 1-2-3 didactic way. I think the good thing about hospitals is that residents rotate round and they see all sorts of consultants at work, and they evaluate and choose from all of that what they themselves are going to be, together with their own worldview and so on that they have. And I think that's the thing to be critical of everyone you work with, and watch carefully and see how they go and take the best from each. And if possible, work with the best. Deliberately choose to work with those people you know that are best.
When and how can you bring the spiritual into this with the families? Is it possible at times? I find that extremely difficult. Mm.
Well, I do too in the public hospital situation, and particularly on ward rounds. There's many of us here who know what it's like to have end students and the nurses and the physio, and it becomes an impersonal, fearsome group of people round the bed, to which the one-to-one situation is very difficult indeed. There are other situations. The Roman Catholic nun that I was talking to, she called my secretary one day and said, "I want to come and talk to you." And she came and sat to me and she said, "Look, you know, I'm really troubled by what you're doing here." She told me how that she really believed in Jungian psychology, and that she had been going through all sorts of techniques to visualize her mother being healed and other things, and it was really quite an amazing thing. And I was able to sort of come back and say to her, "Well, my perspective, from my Christian point of view, is this." And we talked for an hour and a half or so, just trying to at least get the perspective at least understood between us. But you don't often have opportunities in the total practice, and I think that's one of the sad things of public hospital practice. And I know other people have this experience and may want to comment as well. I think that from my point of view, I see myself in the hospital primarily as a doctor, to gain and to exercise as much skills in medicine as possible, and not primarily to be there as an evangelist. And when I have the opportunity, I will, but I am to be a good doctor and to work as I should. I think that is primarily. That's why I'm very interested in the chaplaincy services. And what I've been trying to do is to talk to the chaplains about being servants rather than being sacramental givers. You see, many of the chaplains want to come and give the sacraments to the patients as a religious office, but they don't want to sit beside the relatives in casualty when someone's in a DI cube, or they don't want to sit outside the intensive care with the relatives and maybe get them a cup of coffee and so on. And I've been saying to them that if they really want to relate to people, they have to start at the servant situation. And I'm not sure we're going to win, but we're talking about this. And I had a really great discussion with the Uniting Church guy on Friday morning about this very thing, and he understands. But I think those people, if given the perspective of who have the time and so on, can really begin to make the relationships. We have often such a work schedule to deal with that we can't often spend a lot of time in that sort of thing. Though, of course, there are times that we can spend, and I'm not saying, you know, that this is a cop-out. I'm not sure. Is that answered? Just to perhaps take up your offer, Peter, not in any extensive way, but I think as a general practitioner, I found that there's a tremendous opportunity in just being with people, especially in their home, and even if they're in hospital, visiting them in hospital, because you're not there to sort of take over and order and do things. You're there more as a friend in that situation. And some of those situations can be very, very useful and very, very helpful to people. Just asking you a question, and perhaps picking up, I think, what Ross was beginning to ask you a bit before. The way I get involved with people is in my own mind, or if not in my own mind, in a sort of very overt way, a contract between myself and the person or the family. We sort of undertake to die well, and rather than just to die, and that encompasses this sort of total holistic attitude towards death. And in every sort of situation I've encountered, that involves dealing with people's relationship hurts and things that have happened that have just been put aside, put under the carpet, forgotten about for a long while, but in the person's deepest sort of sense of their reality knows that they need to deal with them. And I'm just wondering, if it's not pushing you too hard, were there things like that that you and Heather had to come to terms with, and how did you go about it?
I don't think that there were those sort of things that you mentioned. The issue I think was one that that Heather needed to place herself in my hands very substantially in terms of her management. And that she did with just marvellous understanding. When she first had, for instance, the epidural catheter put in it, the morphine dosage turned out to be N times higher than it should have been, and she was terribly sick. She had to trust me to rapidly reduce the morphine dosage and, you know, try to balance this dosage out. And I think that there weren't these issues that needed to be resolved. There were the issues on the nature of suffering and death, which we talked about, not related to her illness, but a long time later. And there were times when I had talked about suffering and death in which she really didn't see the perspective that I had in the same way. And there were times in which we really talked it out and discussed it, and we did have a commonality, I think, of understanding in that way. I don't think that there were personal or sort of marital things that had to be resolved in that sort of situation, because I think the Lord had really brought us together and we had a unity in marriage that was very special. But at the same time, I'd say to you that the fact that we understood that we both belong to the Lord primarily and not each other kind of meant that there was that triangular kind of relationship, that the breaking of it wasn't just totally destructive as it is in many ways, that we both depended on the Lord all the time, and that she knew that I had to depend on the Lord's guidance in that situation. And I don't think within the family there were sort of specific things that needed to be resolved, and so I don't know how we would have gone at coping with those sorts of things. It was interesting that there were one or two people at church in whom she and they didn't necessarily see eye to eye about their understanding of Christianity, for instance. But these couple of people came and sat and they talked, and often they would get onto this very topic and they would work through it. And Heather spent many, many hours talking to people who came to visit in that way. And I wouldn't say they're all resolved, but it is a time in which that if you are dying, people actually listen often to what you say. Whereas often they don't, no matter how it's said. It's very human of us to be like that. But of course we had tensions in the family. There were members of the family that weren't Christians and didn't really understand the perspective that we had. And it was devastating and difficult. There was one other thing that your question brought up, and I didn't mention it, but it seemed to me that as things occurred, that I should be a husband and a father, and not a doctor primarily. And I very substantially handed over the decisions on management to the haematologist, oncologist, the surgeon, and the radiotherapist that were involved. And I did not take major parts in the decision about treatment at all. And I trusted those people. I think it's terribly important that if a member of a doctor's family gets sick, that they choose not necessarily a Christian, but the person whom they feel has the best expertise to deal with the problem, and then relate as they will. I did actually do a lot of the day-to-day management and adjustment of doses and opiates and other things, but the big decisions I really did leave to them, and I was really a husband for Heather. And as I reflect on it, I think that was right. I didn't necessarily search the literature on this, that and the other. I didn't worry about, you know, whether there was a controlled double-blind trial on whatever. And I wrote to the doctors at the end of each one, when Heather had died, and explained to them that it really was such a marvellous contribution to me that I could be a husband and not a doctor to Heather during her illness.
Related theme, Peter, did you think it was made more difficult for the doctors looking after Heather because you yourself were a doctor? Because it seems sometimes that when we come across illness in colleagues, sometimes we're embarrassed, sometimes we become over-involved, sometimes under-involved, sometimes it's a bit of an uncomfortable situation. Was that your experience at all, and how did you come through that?
Yeah. Heather and I talked a lot about the impact of the disease and its progression and things like that. I don't think that there was a lot of embarrassment between me and the people involved. The surgeon knew that I couldn't take an appendix out with four hands and 2 feet if I had them, so he wasn't terribly worried, I don't think. The radiotherapist, likewise, was in such a special area that was a pretty straightforward palliative business, and when it had to be done. The haematology oncology side of things, I think the person involved was really good. If he was going to make a decision that was going to be a change, he would often either call me or talk to me when he was around the hospital. And I tried myself to have him understand, even in non-verbal ways, that I appreciated his expertise and was happy with his decisions in general terms. Except for the situation where it was clear that the chemotherapy wasn't working. Now, the haematologist-oncologist involved was also very insensitive, and he indicated to me not in as many words, that he didn't think that the chemotherapy was doing as well as it might. And I really respect for the way that he indicated that. He didn't force the hand. He planted the idea there, and he gave us the room to talk it out and come back to him and say, look, we've talked about it, it's really toxic, it's causing a problem, we can see that there's little change in the symptoms and so on. Because we had a good end point, we had the brachial plexus involved with sensory and motor signs, we would know if the lesion was regressing. And we knew that it wasn't in the final stages. And at that stage, we really had a commonality of ideas, and he said, fine. I think it is very difficult for doctors. I really felt that one of them didn't really share our worldview and didn't necessarily feel very comfortable. And I really felt for the guy who came here the night or the early morning that Heather died and had to write her death certificate, that he had to come to this house and so on after such a long time and we were there and so on. That must have been very hard. But he did it. And with a real sense of appreciation and understanding and quiet dignity about it. And I really think that what you're saying is right, that there is difficulty in dealing with one's colleagues. But I think the norms of human sensitivity deal with them pretty easily, provided that person is not anxious about your technical ability. I think that's a real problem. If he really thinks that you're not much good in your technical understanding and carrying out of your decisions in medicine, then you've got a real problem. And I think there you change your doctor quick smart. But we fortunately didn't have that difficulty. But I think it would occur in other ways. I know, for instance, of one doctor whose wife had breast cancer, who just was so restless and so anxious and kept searching every journal as it came out to see if there was something new and, you know, calling about why shouldn't we change this dose or that dose. And that's totally understandable in a sense.
Because if you're going to be primarily a husband to Heather, that meant that primarily to the doctors looking after Heather, you were to be the
husband of the patient, not a colleague.
Yeah,
primarily.
That's right. And when I went to the hematology oncology appointments with Heather, I deliberately would go in like a husband and talk in the non-medical, non-jargonistic way, so that there was nothing shared between us that Heather wasn't clearly understanding. So I think it was really a husband situation. Although, of course, by that time Heather had gleaned, being as intelligent as she was, an awful lot about the goings and comings of the whole disorder and so on. I think we would all respond very differently to that, and it would depend on the doctor involved as well.
Just to pick that up and sort of enunciate perhaps an underlying practical point that comes out of it. I think as a doctor treating another doctor, you ought to assume that the doctor being treated is not medically qualified, and you should therefore explain to them and the family exactly what you would explain to every other non-medically qualified patient. There is a tendency to assume that the doctor who is the patient or the spouse of the patient will know what's going on and will know the pros and cons of different aspects of treatment and disease, whereas in fact it's going to be outside of his specialty and he won't know. And he won't necessarily ask the questions.